Religion did not mean an hour a week on Sundays to this crowd. There was Bible study, youth group, fellowship, and retreats. The thought for the day started the morning. Scripture came before bed. West Bowles kids roamed the halls of Columbine sporting WWJD bracelets, What Would Jesus Do?, and exchanging Christian rock CDs. Occasionally, they witnessed to the unbelievers or argued scripture with the mainline Protestants. The Columbine Bible Study Group met at the school once a week. Its major challenges were resisting temptation, adhering to a higher standard, and acting as worthy servants of Christ. Its members kept a vigilant eye out for the enemy. Pastors Kirsten and Uta Molin spoke of Satan frequently. Reverend Uta Molin called him by name. Kirsten preferred the enemy. Either way, Satan was more than a symbol of evil. He was an actual physical entity, hungry for compliant souls. He snatched the most unlikely targets. Who would have expected Cassie Bernal to fall? She was the angelic blonde junior who dressed up for a function at the Marriott on Saturday instead of prom. She was scheduled to speak at her church's youth group meeting on Tuesday. Cassie's house sat right beside Columbine property, but it was only her second year at the school. She transferred in from Christian Fellowship School. She had begged her parents to make the move. The Lord had spoken to Cassie. He wanted her to witness to the unbelievers at Columbine. Monday morning was uneventful. Lots of bleary eyes from Saturday's all-nighter. Lots of chatter about who did what. All Mr. D's kids had made it back. A handful peeked through his doorway with big grins. "Just wanted you to see our bright, shining faces," they said. Supervisory Special Agent Duane Fuselier was a little on edge Monday. He headed the FBI's domestic terrorism unit in Denver, and April 19th was a dangerous day in the region. The worst disaster in FBI history had erupted 6 years earlier, and retaliation followed exactly 2 years after. On April 19th, 1993, the Bureau ended a 51-day standoff with the Branch Davidian cult near Waco, Texas, by storming the compound. A massive fire had erupted, and most of the 80 inhabitants burned to death, adults and children. Agent Fuselier was one of the nation's foremost hostage negotiators. He spent 6 weeks trying to talk the Davidians out. Fuselier had opposed the attack on the compound, but lost. Just before storming in, the FBI gave Fuselier one final chance. He was the last person known to speak to Davidian leader David Koresh. He watched the compound burn. Speculation raged about the FBI's role in the blaze. The controversy nearly ended Attorney General Janet Reno's career. Waco radicalized the anti-government militia movement, made April 19th into a symbol of perverse authority. Timothy McVeigh sought vengeance by bombing the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City on April 19, 1995. His explosion killed 168 people, the largest terrorist attack in American history to that point. 8. Maximum Human Density. It's a safe bet that Eric and Dylan watched the carnage of Waco and Oklahoma City on television with the rest of the country. Those atrocities were particularly prominent in this region. McVeigh was tried in federal court in downtown Denver and sentenced to death while the boys attended Columbine in the suburbs. The scenes of devastation were played over and over. In his journal, Eric would brag about topping McVeigh. Oklahoma City was a one-note performance. McVeigh set his timer and walked away. He didn't even see his spectacle unfold. Eric dreamed much bigger than that. Judgment Day, they called it. Columbine would erupt with an explosion, too. Eric designed at least 7 big bombs, working off the anarchist cookbook he found on the web. He chose the barbecue design, standard propane tanks, the fat round white ones, 18 inches tall, a foot in diameter, packing some 20 pounds of highly explosive gas. Bomb number one employed aerosol cans for detonators, each wired up to an old-fashioned alarm clock with round metal bells on top. Step one was planting them in a park near Eric's house, 3 miles from the school. That bomb could kill hundreds of people, but was intended for only stones and trees. The attack was to begin with a decoy, rock the neighborhood, and divert police. Every free minute raised the potential body count. The boys were going to double or triple McVeigh's record. They estimated the damage variously as hundreds, several hundred, and at least 400. Oddly conservative for the arsenal they were preparing. Eric may have had another reason for the decoy plan. He was uncannily perceptive about people, and Dylan had been wavering. If Dylan was reticent, the decoy would help ease him in. It was a harmless explosive. No one would be hurt by it. But once they drove off, Dylan would be committed. The main event was scripted in three acts, just like a movie. It would kick off with a massive explosion in the commons. More than 600 students swarmed in at the start of A lunch. And 2 minutes after the bell rang, most of them would be dead.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 2. Columbine, by Dave Cullen, continued. Disc 2.
Act 1 featured two bombs using propane tanks like the decoy. Each was strung with nails and BBs for shrapnel, lashed to a full gasoline can and a smaller propane tank, and wired to similar bell clocks. Each bomb fits snugly into a duffel bag, which Eric and Dylan would lug in at the height of passing period chaos. Again, Dylan was eased into killing. Clicking over the alarm hinge was bloodless and impersonal. It didn't feel like killing. No blood, no screams. Most of Dylan's murders would be over before he faced them. The fireball would wipe out most of the lunch crowd and set the school ablaze. Eric drew detailed diagrams. He spaced the bombs out, but located them centrally for maximum killing radius. They would sit beside two thick columns supporting the second floor. Computer modeling and field tests would later demonstrate a high probability that the bombs would have collapsed some of the second floor. Eric apparently hoped to watch the library and its inhabitants crash down upon the flaming lunchers. As the time bombs ticked down, the killers would exit briskly and flare out across the parking lot at a 90-degree angle. Each boy was to head for his own car, strategically parked about 100 yards apart. The cars provided mobile base camps, where they would gear up to unleash Act 2. Pre-positioning ensured optimal fire lanes. They had drilled the gear-ups repeatedly and could execute them rapidly. The bombs would detonate at 11:17, and the densely packed wing would crumble. As the flames leapt up, Eric and Dylan would train their semi-automatics on the exits and await survivors. Act 2, firing time. This was going to be fun. Dylan would sport an Intratec TEC DC-9, a 9mm semi-automatic handgun, and a shotgun. Eric had a high-point 9mm carbine rifle and a shotgun. They sawed the barrels off the shotguns for concealment. Between them, they'd carry 80 portable explosives, pipe bombs and carbon dioxide bombs that Eric called crickets, plus a supply of Molotov cocktails and an assortment of freakish knives in case it came down to hand-to-hand combat. They'd suit up in infantry-style web harnesses, allowing them to strap much of the ammo and explosives to their bodies. Each had a backpack and a duffel bag to hump more hardware into the attack zone. They would tape flint match striker strips to their forearms for rapid-fire pipe bomb attacks. Their long black dusters would go on last, for concealment and for looking badass. Later, the dusters were widely referred to as trench coats. They planned to advance on the building as soon as the bombs blew. They'd be set back far enough to see each other around the corner and just barely avoid the blast. They had devised their own hand signals to communicate. Every detail was planned. Battle positions were imperative. The 250,000 square foot school had 25 exits, so some survivors would escape. The boys could remain in visual contact and still cover two sides of the building, including two of the three main exits. Their firing lines intersected on the most important point, the student entrance, adjacent to the commons and just a dozen yards from the big bombs. Positioning yourself at a right angle to the objective is standard U.S. infantry practice, taught to every American foot soldier at the infantry school in Fort Benning, Georgia. Interlocking fire lanes, the military calls it. The target is constantly under fire from two sides, yet the assault team's weapons are never pointed at Confederates. Even if a shooter turns sharply to peg an escaping enemy, his squad mates are safe. From their initial positions, Eric and Dylan could sweep their gun barrels across a 90-degree firing radius without endangering each other. Even if one shooter advanced more quickly, he would never violate his partner's fire lane. It is both the safest and the most effective assault pattern of modern small-arms warfare. This was the phase Eric and Dylan were savoring. It was also when they expected to die. They had little hope of witnessing Act 3. 45 minutes after the initial blast, when the cops declared it was over, paramedics started loading amputees into ambulances and reporters broadcast the horror to a riveted nation. Eric's Honda and Dylan's BMW would rip right through the camera crews and the first responders. Each car was to be loaded with two more propane devices and 20 gallons of gasoline in an assortment of orange plastic jugs. Their positions had been chosen to maximize both the firepower in Act 2 and the carnage in Act 3. The cars would be close to the building, near the main exits, ideal locations for police command, emergency medical staging, and news vans. They would be just far enough from the building and each other to wipe out most of the junior and senior parking lots. Maximum body count, nearly 2,000 students, plus 150 faculty and staff, plus who knows how many police, paramedics, and journalists. Eric and Dylan had been considering a killing spree for at least a year and a half. They had settled on the approximate time and location a year out, April, in the Commons. They finalized details as Judgment Day approached, Monday, April 19th. The date appeared firm. The boys referred to it twice, matter-of-factly, in the recordings they made in the last 10 days. They did not explain the choice, though Eric discussed topping Oklahoma City, so they may have been planning to echo that anniversary, as Tim McVeigh had done with Waco. The moment of attack was critical. Students liked to eat early, so a lunch was the most popular. The maximum human density anywhere, anytime in the high school, occurred in the Commons at 11:17. Eric knew the exact minute because he had inventoried his targets. He'd counted just 60 to 80 kids scattered about the Commons from 10:30 to 10:50. Between 10:56 and 10:58, lunch ladies bring out shit, he wrote. Then lunch door 2 opened, and a steady trickle of people appeared. He recorded the exact moment each door opened, and body counts in minute-by-minute increments. At 11:10, the bell rang. Fourth period ended. Students piled into the hallways. Moments later, they rushed the lunch lines, 50 more every minute, 300, 350, 400, 450, 500-plus by 11:15. Eric and Dylan's various handwritten timelines show the bomb scheduled to explode between 11:16 and 11:18. The final times are followed by little quips, "Have fun," and "Ha, ha, ha." Eric and Dylan expected their attack to puzzle the public, so they left an extraordinary cache of material to explain themselves. They kept schedules, budgets, maps, drawings, and all sorts of logistical artifacts, along with commentary in notebooks, journals, and websites. A series of videos were specifically designed to explain their attack. They would come to be known as the basement tapes because the bulk were shot in Eric's basement. Even more illuminating was Eric's 20-page journal devoted to his thinking. Both chronicles are revealing, but also maddeningly contradictory. They were so disturbing that the sheriff's department would choose to hide them from the public, concealing even the existence of the basement tapes for months. Eric and Dylan's true intentions would remain a mystery for years. The date was the first element of Eric's plan to fail, apparently because of ammo. On Monday, he had nearly 700 rounds for the four guns. He wanted more. He had just turned 18, so he could buy his own, but that fact somehow escaped him. He was used to relying on others, and he thought Mark Maines could help. Maines was a drug dealer who ran some guns and ammo on the side. He had come through with the Tech 9 in January, but he was dragging ass on the ammo. Thursday night, Eric began hounding him to come up with this stuff. 4 days later, Eric remained empty-handed. They could have gone ahead without the extra ammo, but their firepower would have been impaired. Shotguns are not built for rapid-fire assault. The Tech 9 took 20 and 30-round magazines. Dylan could release one with the flick of a button and pop in a new mag with a single sweep of the hand. Real gun aficionados hate the thing. It's too big and bulky for a professional and way too unreliable. A poor man's Uzi. Dealers complain of slapdash design, frequent misfeeds, and a lousy sighting mechanism that is often misaligned and can't be adjusted. Cheap construction and marginal reliability, says a major Russian gun dealer's website. But it was available. Eric and Dylan had a mostly uneventful Monday. They got up before sunrise to make bowling class by 6 a.m. They cut fourth hour for an extended lunch at Blackjack and attended their other classes as usual. That evening, Maine suddenly came through with the ammo. He'd gotten it at Kmart, two boxes with 50 rounds apiece. Together, they cost $25. Eric drove to Maine's house to pick up the ammo. He seemed eager to get it. Maine asked if Eric was going shooting that night. "Maybe tomorrow," Eric said. 9. Dads. Dave Sanders had never talked about regret before. Not to Frank DeAngelis. They talked every day. They had been close for 20 years, but they had never gone there. It came up unexpectedly on Monday afternoon. Frank strolled out to the baseball diamond to watch his boys take on arch-rival Chatfield. He had coached the team before he went into administration, alongside his old friend Dave Sanders. And there at the top of the bleachers was Dave, watching right now. He had a couple of hours to kill until his girls arrived for basketball practice. The season was over, but they were working fundamentals for next year. Dave could have spent the time grading papers, but it was hard to fight the lure of the field. Mr. D said hi to the kids, excited to see him there, then sat down next to Dave. They talked for 2 hours. They talked about everything, their entire lives. Coaching, of course. The first time they met, when Frank arrived at Columbine in 1979. He was one of the shortest teachers on the faculty, and the principal recruited him to coach basketball. "They needed a freshman coach, and I was on a 1-year contract," Frank said. The principal said, "Frank, if you do me this one favor, I owe you one." "And what am I going to say? I'll do whatever you want, sir." So I coached basketball. The conversation was lighthearted for a long time, Dave cutting up as usual. Then he turned serious. "Do you miss coaching?" he asked. "Not really." Frank's answer sort of surprised Dave. Coaching was his life, Frank explained, but he had never really left it. He just expanded his audience. "You think so?" Dave wondered. "Oh, yeah," Frank said. "You can't really teach a kid anything. You can only show him the way and motivate him to learn it himself. Same thing applies to shortstops turning the double play and students grasping the separation of powers in the U.S. government. It's all the same job." Now he had to coach teachers, too, to inspire their own kids to learn. "What about you?" Frank asked. "Any regrets?" "Yeah, too much coaching." They shared a good laugh. Seriously, though, Dave said, his family had come second to coaching. God, his family came second. Frank suppressed another laugh. His own son, Brian, was 19. Frank was confident he had been a good dad, but never enough of one. It had rankled his wife since day one, and recently she had laid into him about it. When are you going to stop raising everybody else's kids and start raising your own? That stung. It was a little hard to share, but this seemed like the moment, and Dave seemed like the guy. Dave understood. It was bittersweet for both of them. They had reached middle age blissfully. They wouldn't change a moment for their own sake. But had they shortchanged their kids? Frank's son was grown now, and Dave's daughters were too. Too late. But they were still young women, and Dave had 5 grandkids and was hoping for more. Dave had not told the other coaches he was coming back yet. He had not announced his decision to take off the first summer in memory. He confided it all to Frank now. What an amazing guy, Frank thought. He thought about hugging Dave. He did not. The game was still going, but Dave got up. My girls are waiting for me, he said. I have open gym. Frank watched him walk slowly away. Coach Sanders had something else on his mind. He had held his first team meeting last Friday, and his new team captain, Liz Carlston, had failed to show. He expected to see her tonight. It was going to be a tense conversation, and it wasn't going to be just her. Sanders sat all the girls down on the court. They talked a lot about dedication. How was it going to look to the freshmen if the team leaders mouthed the words, then failed to show up? He expected a 100% commitment, every practice, every meeting, or you're out. He told them to scrimmage. He let them keep at it the entire evening. He sat on a folding chair, watching, analyzing, preparing. At the end of the night, Liz tried to summon the courage to talk to him. She had just blanked on the meeting. She hadn't meant anything by it. She felt guilt and fear and anger. He wouldn't actually cut her, would he? Why hadn't he given her a chance to explain? She stopped at the baseline to change her shoes. Coach Sanders was right there. She should talk to him. She walked out, quietly. She didn't even say goodbye. Linda Lou was asleep when Dave got home that night. He kissed her softly. She woke up and smiled. Dave was holding a wad of cash, a thick stash, 70 singles. He flung them toward her, and they fluttered down onto the comforter. She got excited. She loved his little surprises, but she wasn't sure what this was about. He went with it for a minute, got her hopes up, and then said she was silly. It was for her mom. Linda's mom was turning 70 on April 20th. She liked to gamble. She would like that. Dave was all laughs that night with Linda. She was shocked when she learned later how tense his evening had been. "That's how the man could change," she said. Walked through our door and he was done with basketball. Now he was thinking of my mom. He went down to fix himself a Diet Coke and rum. He found a game. Linda fell back asleep with a smile. Morning was less pleasant. The alarm sounded at 6:30. Linda and Dave were both in a rush. Linda had to pick up balloons for her mom's birthday party, and Dave had to drop Linda's poodle off for a haircut. Dave had no time for breakfast. He snagged an energy bar and a banana for the car. It was trash day, his job, but he was going to be late. He asked Linda if she would do it. She was too stressed. "I really don't have time today. I'm really going to be late," he muttered. They rushed out to separate cars and realized they had forgotten to kiss goodbye. They always kissed goodbye. Dave blew her a kiss from the driveway. 10. Judgment. On Tuesday morning, the boys rose early as usual. It was dark, but warm already, set to soar into the 80s with blue skies, perfect for their fires. It was going to be a beautiful day. Dylan was out of the house by 5:30. His parents were still in bed. He called out, "Bye," and shut the door behind himself. They skipped bowling class and went straight to work. Dylan scrawled the schedule into Eric's day planner under the heading, Make Today Count. Eric illustrated it with a blazing gun barrel. First stop was the grocery store, where they met up to acquire the last of the propane tanks, two for the cafeteria, two for each car, and two for the decoy. The big bombs were the heart of the attack. Eric had designed them months before, but had left acquisition to the final morning. The boys had stashed most of the arsenal in Eric's bedroom closet, and he had faced a couple of close calls with his parents already. Hiding a cluster of 20-pound tanks in there was out of the question. They returned to Eric's house at 7, and then split up. Eric filled the propane tanks, Dylan got the gasoline. They allotted half an hour to assemble the big bombs and set up the cars, and an hour for one last round of gear-up, practice, and chill. They got something to eat. Dylan apparently had potato skins. Several friends noticed peculiarities. Robin Anderson was surprised to see Dylan a no-show for calculus. He had sounded fine on the phone the previous night. Then a friend told her Eric had been missing from third hour. The boys cut an occasional class together, but never an entire morning. Robin hoped Dylan wasn't sick. She made a mental note to call once she got home. Their friend, Brooks Brown, had a stronger reaction. Eric had missed a test in psychology class. What kind of stunt was that? Chill time was over. It had gone on too long, perilously over schedule. Shortly before 11 a.m., Eric and Dylan set off with the arsenal. Dylan wore cargo pants, a black T-shirt printed with Wrath, and his red socks cap turned backward as usual. His cargo pockets were deep enough to conceal most of the sawed-off shotgun before he pulled on the duster. Eric's T-shirt said Natural Selection. They both wore black combat boots and shared a single pair of black gloves, the right on Eric, the left on Dylan. They left two pipe bombs behind at Eric's house, six at Dylan's. Eric laid a microcassette on the kitchen counter with some final thoughts. They also left the basement tapes with a final goodbye recorded that morning. They drove separate cars to a park near Eric's house, dumped the decoy bomb in a field, and set the timers for 11:14. Combat operations were underway. They hopped back in their cars and headed for the school. They had to hustle now. The last few minutes were critical. They couldn't plant the big bombs until A lunch began. Fourth period ended at 11:10. Once the bell rang, they had 7 minutes to carry the bombs in, navigate the turbulent lunch crowd, stash the bombs by the designated pillars, get back to their cars, gear up, take cover, and prepare to attack. Eric pulled into the parking lot at 11:10, several minutes behind schedule. A couple of girls spotted his car as they headed out for lunch. They honked and waved. They liked him. Eric waved back and smiled. Dylan followed him in. No waves. Dylan drove to his normal spot in the senior lot and parked his BMW directly in front of the cafeteria. When the attack began, this would afford him a clear sweep of the southwest side of the building, the long, wide arc of green-tinted windows that wrapped the commons on the first floor and the library above. Eric continued on to the small junior lot, about 100 yards to Dylan's right. Eric had the choice spot, directly facing the student entrance, where the bulk of the survivors would presumably flee. He could also cover the full southeast side of the building and interlock his fire with Dylan's to his left. Brooks Brown walked out for a cigarette and spotted Eric parking in the wrong lot. Brooks charged up to confront him about the test. By the time he got there, Eric had stepped out and was pulling out a big hulking duffel bag. "What's the matter with you?" Brooks yelled. "We had a test in psychology." Eric was calm, but insistent. "It doesn't matter anymore," he said. "Brooks, I like you now. Get out of here. Go home." Brooks thought that was strange, but he shook his head and walked on, away from the school. Eric's friend Nate Dykeman also caught sight of him arriving and also found the circumstances strange. Eric headed in with his duffel. By 11:12, they were scheduled to be back at their cars, arming up. A surveillance tape, time-stamped 11:14, indicates they had still not entered the Commons. They had less than 3 minutes. The timers were set for 11:17. There was only a modest chance that they could make it to safety in time, and they could hardly have hoped to be locked and loaded when the bombs blew. They could have reset the timers and sacrificed a few casualties. That would have required coordination, as they had parked across the lot from each other, and it would be risky to expose the bombs inside the cafeteria. They could have abandoned the plan, but the decoy bombs might already be exploding. Shortly after 11:14, they entered the Commons. They moved inconspicuously enough to go unnoticed. Not one of the 500 witnesses noticed them or the big, bulky bags. One of the bags would be found inches from two tables strewn with food. They made it out and armed quickly. It was just like the drill, except this time each was alone, close enough for hand signals, too far to hear. They strapped on their arsenals, covered them with the dusters. Time was tight, and they broke with their drill, leaving the shotguns in the duffel bags. Each boy had a semi-automatic against his body, a shotgun in his bag, and a backpack full of pipe bombs and crickets. This is probably the moment they set the timers on their car bombs. It would just be a matter of seconds now. Hundreds of kids dead. As far as they knew, they had instigated mass murder already. The timers were winding down. Nothing to do but wait. Surveillance cameras should have caught the killers placing the bombs. They would have, if either the bombers or the custodian had been on time. Every morning, the custodian followed the same routine. A few minutes before a lunch, he pulled out the pre-lunch tape and set it aside for later viewing. He popped an old, used tape into the machine, rewound it, and hit record. Rewinding took up to 5 minutes, meaning a brief pause in taping. Kids could leave all the garbage they wanted during that window, but hardly anyone was around to do so. The custodian was running late on Tuesday. He hit the stop button at 11:14, and no bombs were visible. Neither was Eric or Dylan. While waiting out the rewind, the custodian got a phone call. He talked, and the tape sat a little longer. He got the new tape in and hit record at 11:22, leaving an 8-minute gap. The first frame shows the bombs visible and students near the windows beginning to react. Something peculiar outside has caught their attention. Columbine ran on a bell schedule, and most of its inhabitants followed a strict routine. Several of them had broken it Tuesday morning. Patrick Ireland, the junior afraid to ask Laura to the prom, liked variety. Some days he spent a lunch in the library, others in the cafeteria. He had stayed up late talking to Laura on the phone again, and still had to finish his stats homework. So he headed to the library with four of his buddies as Eric and Dylan positioned the duffel bags. Patrick sat down at a table just above one of the bombs. Cassie Bernal, the evangelical junior who had transferred to Columbine to enlighten non-believers, pulled up a chair near the window. It was unusual to find her in the library at this hour. She was also behind on her homework, trying to complete an English assignment on Macbeth. But she was happy she had finished the presentation she would be making to her youth group that night. Mr. D was oddly absent from the cafeteria. His secretary had booked an interview, delaying his rounds. He sat in his office at the opposite end of the main corridor, waiting for a young teacher to arrive. Mr. D was about to offer him a permanent position. Deputy Neil Gardner, the community resource officer, worked for the sheriff's department but was assigned full-time to Columbine. He normally ate with the kids, and a lunch was his optimal chance for bonding, a key element of his job. He wore the same security uniform with the bright yellow shirt every day, so he was easy to spot. Tuesday, Gardner took a break from his normal routine. He didn't care for the teriyaki on the menu, so he went for takeout from Subway with his campus boss, an unarmed civilian security guard. It was a beautiful day. Lots of kids were outside, so they decided to check out the smokers. They ate their sandwiches in Gardner's squad car in the faculty lot beside the smoker's pit on the opposite side of the school. Robin Anderson sat in her car nearby. She had driven out of the senior lot just about the time Eric and Dylan were hauling the bombs in, but had missed them. She'd swung around the building to pick up two friends. She got antsy. Lunchtime was slipping away. 5 minutes passed, maybe 10. Finally, the girls appeared. Robin snarled at them, and they drove off. On the opposite end of the school, shots had already been fired. A freshman named Danny Rohrbaugh went to the Commons to meet up with two buddies. After a few minutes, they decided to head out for a smoke. If the bombs had worked, that choice might have saved him. He might have gotten out just in time. They headed out a side exit at the worst moment, directly alongside the senior parking lot. The bombers spent a minute or two by their cars. They knew the diversionary bomb should have already blown 3 miles to the south. In fact, it had fizzled. A surveyor working in the area had moved it, and the pipe bombs and one of the spray cans had detonated, producing a loud bang and a grass fire. But the propane tanks, the main explosive force, lay undisturbed in the burning field. The decoy was Eric's only big bomb to ignite at all, but one of his dumber ideas. Officials learned of it just as the shooting started, 4 minutes before the first call from the school. The chief effect was to alert authorities that something was amiss in the area. Nothing of consequence was diverted. Eric and Dylan had to proceed on faith. As far as Eric and Dylan knew, cops were already speeding south. They would see the Commons disintegrate, though. Each car was positioned for a perfect view. The cafeteria would explode in front of them. They would watch their classmates be torn apart and incinerated, and their high school burning to the ground. 11. Female Down. At 11:18, the school stood intact. Some kids had already made it through the lunch lines and were strolling outside, settling onto the lawn for a little picnic. No sign of disturbance. The timing devices were not precise. No digital readouts with seconds counting down in red numerals. They were old-fashioned clocks, with a third little alarm hand positioned two-fifths of the way between the 3 and the 4. But they should have blown by now. Hundreds of targets streamed out the student entrance. They hopped into their cars and zipped away. Time for Plan B. There was no Plan B. Eric had staggering confidence in himself. He left no indication that he planned for contingencies. Dylan left no indication that he planned much of anything. They could just proceed to Act 2, mow the departers down in a crossfire, and advance on the exits as scripted. They still could have topped McVeigh, but they didn't. The bomb failure appears to have rattled one of the boys. No one observed what happened next. Either boy might have panicked, but Eric was unflappable, the reverse of his partner. The physical evidence also points to Dylan. Eric apparently acted swiftly to retrieve his emotional young partner. We don't know whether they employed their hand signals or how they came together. We know that Eric was in the prime location, yet abandoned it to come to Dylan's. And Eric moved quickly. Within 2 minutes, Eric had figured out that the bombs had failed, grabbed his packs, crossed the lot to Dylan's car, rushed with him to the building, and climbed the external stairs to the west exit. That's the first place they were observed at 11:19. Their new position set them on the highest point on campus, where they could survey both lots and all the exits on that side of the building. But it took them away from their primary target, the student entrance, still disgorging students. They could no longer triangulate or advance aggressively without separating. At 11:19, they opened the duffel bags at the top of the stairs, pulled out the shotguns, and strapped them to their bodies. They locked and loaded the semi-automatics. One of them yelled, "Go! Go!" Somebody, almost certainly Eric, opened fire. Eric wheeled around and shot at anyone he could see. Dylan cheered him on. He rarely fired. They hit pedestrians among the trees, picnickers to the south, kids coming up the stairs to the east. They tossed pipe bombs down the stairs, into the grass and onto the roof, and they shared a whole lot of hoots and howls and hearty laughs. What a freaking wild time. Rachel Scott and her friend Richard Castaldo were the first down. They had been eating their lunch in the grass. Eric shot Richard in the arms and torso. He hit Rachel in the chest and head. Rachel died instantly. Richard played dead. Eric fell for it. Danny and his smoking buddies Lance Kirkland and Sean Graves were headed up the dirt path toward the stairs. They saw the gunmen firing, but assumed it was a paintball game or a senior prank. It looked like fun. They rushed straight toward the shooters to get closer to the action. Danny got out ahead, making it halfway up the stairs. Eric pivoted and fired his carbine rifle. A shot tore through Danny's left knee, in the front and out the back. He stumbled and began to fall. Eric fired again and again. As Danny collapsed, he took a second bullet to the chest and a third to the abdomen. The upper round went straight through him as well, causing severe trauma to his heart. It stopped pumping immediately. The third shot lacerated his liver and stomach, causing major organ damage and lodging inside. Lance tried to catch Danny, but realized he had been hit too, multiple times, in the chest, leg, knee, and foot. Danny's face hit the concrete sidewalk. Death was almost instantaneous. Lance went down on the grass. He blacked out, but continued to breathe. Sean burst out laughing. He was sure it was paintball. They were part of the game now. Sean felt a shot zip by his neck. It left a cool breeze in its wake. He felt a couple of pricks, like an IV needle being pulled out. He did not realize he had been shot. He looked around. Both his friends were down. Pain signals reached Sean's brain. It felt like someone had kicked him in the back. He ran back for the door they had come out. He nearly made it, but the pain overcame him. His legs gave out, and he collapsed. He couldn't feel his legs anymore. He could not understand what had happened. He seemed to have been shot by a tranquilizer gun. Eric turned again and spotted five kids under a clump of pines in the grass. He fired, and the kids took off running. One fell. He played dead, too. Another took a hit but kept on running. The last three got away clean. The shooters kept moving. Lance regained consciousness. He felt someone hovering over him. He reached up toward the guy, tugged on his pant leg, and cried for help. "Sure, I'll help," the gunman said. The wait seemed like forever to Lance. He described the next event as a sonic blast that twisted his face apart. He watched chunks of it fly away. Breaths came rapidly, air in, blood out. He faded out again. Dylan made his way down the hill toward Sean. Several people in the cafeteria saw him coming. Someone ran out, grabbed Sean, and started dragging him in. An adult stopped him. She said it was dangerous to move a seriously injured person. Sean ended up propped in the entrance with the door pressed against him. Someone tried to step over him on the way out, planted a foot into Sean's back, and said, "Oh, sorry, dude." A janitor came by and reassured Sean. He held Sean's hand, said he would stay with him, but he had to help kids escape first. He advised Sean to play dead. Sean did. Dylan fell for it again, or pretended to. He stepped right over Sean's crumpled body and walked inside. A stampede was underway in there. The lunch crowd had panicked. Most took cover under tables. Some ran for the stairs. Coach Sanders heard the commotion in the faculty lounge and ran toward the danger. "I don't think he even thought about it," his daughter Angela said later. "His instinct was to save his kids." Dave burst into the commons and tried to take charge. Two custodians followed him to assist. Sanders directed students to get down. He rethought that pretty quickly and yelled, "Run!" Sanders looked around. There were exits in three directions, but most of them looked bad. There was one plausible option, across the commons and up the wide concrete stairway to the second floor. No telling what was up there, but anything was better than this. Sanders led the way. He ran across the open room unprotected, waving his arms to get the kids' attention and yelling for them to follow. The tables offered little true protection, but they felt a lot safer. It was scary out in the open. The kids trusted Coach Sanders, though. A wave of students swelled behind Sanders. Most of the 488 people in the commons followed him toward the stairs. He bolted to the top and spun around to direct traffic. To the left! To the left! He sent them all down the corridor toward the east exit, away from the senior parking lot. The whole time, he was just saving people, a student said. He took me and just pushed me into a room. Some students stopped to warn others. Some just ran. Someone ran into the choir room and yelled, "There's a gun!" Half the kids took cover. The other half fled. A few doors down, in Science Room 3, students were immersed in a chemistry test. They heard something like rocks being thrown against the windows, but the teacher assumed it was a prank. "Stay seated and concentrate on your test," he said. Dave Sanders stayed behind until every kid had passed. The tail end of the mob was just pushing its way to the stairs as Dylan stepped inside the cafeteria. There were 24 steps. About 100 kids were caught on the staircase, racing for cover on the second floor. They were wedged between each other and the steel railings, nowhere to take cover. They were arrayed at different heights for easy access. Crouching was not an option. Anyone attempting to stop would get trampled. The cafeteria was roughly 100 feet wide. Dylan was in easy firing range. One or two pipe bombs or one burst from his Tech 9 would have halted the entire advance. Dylan took a few steps in, lifted his weapon up to firing position. This was the second time since setting the timers that Dylan separated from Eric. For the second time, Dylan appeared to lose his nerve. He swept his rifle in an arc across the room. He watched the students disappear up the stairs. He did not fire. He had only engaged his weapon a few times. Dylan looked around, then turned and stepped back over Sean in the doorway. The heavy door whacked Sean hard again in its grip. Dylan rejoined Eric at the top of the stairs. It's not clear why Dylan made his cafeteria excursion. Many have speculated that he came down to see what went wrong with the bombs, but he never went near them. He made no attempt at detonation. It's more likely that Eric sent him in to check for opportunities and rev up the body count. Dylan did nothing on his own, but Eric amused himself heartily at the top of the stairs, shooting, laughing, and hurling pipe bombs. He spotted a junior named Anne Marie Hochholter getting up from the curb to make a run for it. Eric hit her with a 9mm round. She kept running, and he hit her again. This time, she went down. A friend picked her up, dragged her to the building, and got her out of Eric's sight. Then he let go of her and ran. He ducked behind a car in the senior lot, and a pipe bomb exploded where Anne Marie had first collapsed. "This is awesome!" one of the killers yelled. By the time Dylan rejoined Eric, they had used up all the easy targets. Everybody caught outside had run like crazy or hidden. One last pack was still in the open. These students had fled across the senior lot, climbed over the chain-link fence, and were racing across the soccer field near the base of Rebel Hill. Eric had a go at them. They were too far. Not out of range, just too hard to hit. Dylan fired at the distant targets, too, bringing his total shot count up to 5. It was 11:23. The killers had enjoyed 4 heady minutes. Deputy Gardner was the first officer alerted. The custodian radioed Gardner as soon as he started the new surveillance tape and caught sight of kids near the windows. The custodian sounded scared. The first 9/11 call came through to Jeffco at the same time. A girl was injured in the senior parking lot. "I think she's paralyzed," the caller said. The dispatch hit the police band at 11:23, just as Gardner drove around the building to the commons and Dylan rejoined Eric at the top of the stairs. "Female down," the dispatcher said. Gardner saw smoke rising and kids running. He heard gunshots and explosions and a flurry of dispatches on his radio. He couldn't quite tell where the commotion was coming from. 4 minutes into the mayhem, much of the student body was oblivious. Hundreds were running for their lives, but more sat quietly in class. Many heard the commotion. Few sensed any danger. Most found it annoying. The chaos and the solitude went on, side by side, often only yards apart. As Dave Sanders ushered kids to the common staircase, part-time art teacher Patty Nielsen paced above him on hall monitor duty. Sanders herded the lunch crowd up the stairwell toward her, but then down a parallel hallway. Nearly 500 kids charged the length of the building. Nielsen never saw or heard them. She heard the racket outside, though. Some kids ran up, saying they heard gunfire. Nielsen was annoyed. It was a prank, obviously, or a video shoot. It had gone on far too long. She looked down the corridor to the west exit. Through the large glass panes in the doors, she could see a boy with his back to her. He had a gun. He was firing it into the senior lot. She assumed it was a prop, a loud one, and totally inappropriate. Nielsen stormed down the hallway to tell him to knock it off. A junior named Brian tagged along to watch. They approached the exit just as the shooters ran out of targets. There were two sets of doors there, separated by an airlock. Nielsen and Brian passed the first set and reached for the second handles. Eric spotted them. He turned, raised the rifle to his shoulder, aimed at Nielsen, and smiled. Then he fired. The glass shattered, but the bullet missed. Nielsen still thought it was a BB gun. Then she saw the size of the hole. "Dear God!" she screamed. "Dear God! Dear God!" She turned to run. He fired again. Another miss, but glass and metal shards and possibly a grazing bullet tore through the back of her shoulder. It burned. Brian had turned too. Nielsen heard him grunt, saw him lurch forward. His back arched, his arms flared, and he hit the floor hard. That looked bad, but he got right up onto his hands and knees to scurry back through the first doors. It was shrapnel, just like hers. She got down too, and they crawled the short distance back to the first doors. They got one partially open and squeezed through. Once they had that door behind them, they rose to their feet and ran. Nielsen was desperate for a phone. The library seemed like an obvious destination. It was just around the corner, spanning most of the south hallway behind a glass wall. Nielsen saw dozens of kids milling about inside, plainly visible to the shooters she pictured on her heels. She never looked back to see. Nielsen ran into the library to warn them. "There's a kid with a gun!" she yelled. There were no adults. That surprised Nielsen. Teacher Rich Long had rushed in moments before, yelled at everyone to get out, and then fled to warn others. Patty Nielsen had the opposite instinct. She ordered them down. Then Nielsen grabbed the phone behind the counter and punched in 9911. She concentrated on details, like the extra 9 for an outside line. Don't waste a second. Nielsen expected the shooter to arrive any moment now, but Eric was not following. He had been distracted. Deputy Gardner had pulled into the lot with lights flashing and siren blaring. Gardner had stepped out of his car, still confused about what he was walking into. Eric opened fire. He got off 10 rounds, all misses. Dylan did nothing. Gardner took cover behind his police car. Eric didn't even hit that. Then his rifle jammed. Eric fought to clear the chamber. Dylan fled into the school. Gardner saw his opening. He laid his pistol across the roof and squeezed off 4 shots. Eric spun around like he'd been hit. Neutralized, Gardner thought. What a relief. Seconds later, Eric was firing again. It was a short burst, then he retreated inside. It was 11:24. The outside ordeal lasted 5 minutes. Eric did most of the shooting. He fired his 9mm rifle 47 times in that period and did not use his shotgun. Dylan got just 3 shots off with his Tech 9 handgun and 2 with his shotgun. They headed down the hallway toward the library. Dave Sanders heard the shots when Eric fired on Patty Nielsen. Coach Sanders ran toward the gunfire. He passed the library entrance just moments after Nielsen ran in. He spotted the killers at the other end of the hallway. He wheeled around and ran for the corner. A boy peeked out of the choir room just in time to see him flee. Sanders wasn't just running for it. He was trying to clear students out of the line of fire. "Get down!" he yelled. 12. The Perimeter. The story took 28 minutes to hit local television. The networks quickly followed. Something awful was happening at a high school near Denver. Coverage began with confused reports about a shooting in the outlying suburbs. No confirmation on injuries, but multiple shots, as many as 9, and possible explosions. Automatic weapons might be involved, possibly even grenades. A fire had been reported. SWAT teams were mobilizing. CNN was locked in on Kosovo. NATO had gone to war over the genocide there. Night had just fallen in Belgrade, and American warplanes were massing on the horizon, about to pulverize fresh targets across the Serb capital. At 11:54 a.m. Denver time, CNN cut to Jeffco and stayed there nonstop all afternoon. The broadcast networks began interrupting the soaps. Columbine quickly overshadowed the war. No one seemed to know what had actually happened. Was it still happening? Apparently. As the networks went live with the story, gunfire and explosions were erupting somewhere inside that school. Outside, it was mayhem. Choppers circled, and police, firefighters, parents, and journalists had descended on the campus. Nobody was going inside. Fresh waves of support troops were arriving by the minute, but they just crowded around the building. Occasionally, students would scurry out. Local stations kept surveying the area hospitals. "There are no patients yet," a journalist reported from one, "but they are expecting one victim with an ankle wound." Jeffco 9/11 operators were overwhelmed. Hundreds of students were still inside the building. Many had cell phones and were calling with conflicting reports. Thousands of parents from all around the area were dialing the same center, demanding information. Many students gave up on 911 and called the TV stations. Local anchors began interviewing them live on the air, and the cable networks picked up their feeds. Witnesses confirmed injuries. A girl said she watched, like, 3 people get shot. "Did it look like they were shooting at specific people?" a reporter asked. "They were just shooting. They didn't care who they shot at. They were just shooting, and then they threw a grenade or they threw something that blew up." There seemed to be no end of witnesses, though most had seen chaos but no one causing it. A senior described the first moments of awareness. "Okay, I was sitting in math class, and all of a sudden we look out, and there's people that are sprinting down the math hall, and we open the door, we hear a shot, loud bang, and then we hear some guy go, 'Holy crap, there's a guy with a gun!' So everybody starts freaking out. One of my friends goes up to the door and says, 'There's a guy standing there.' We evacuate to the corner of our classroom, and my teacher just doesn't know what to do because she's so freaked." There appeared to be several shooters, all boys, all white, all Columbine students. Some were shooting in the parking lot, some in the cafeteria, some upstairs while roaming the halls. Somebody was positioned on the roof. Some of the assault team wore T-shirts. Others advanced in long black trench coats. One pair included one of each. Some had hats, and one or two were hiding behind ski masks. Some of this mix-up was standard crime scene confusion. Contrary to popular conception, witness testimony is notoriously unreliable, especially when witnesses were under duress. Memories get jumbled, and witnesses imagine missing details without realizing they're doing it. But much of this misunderstanding was due to specific factors. Eric discarded his trench coat at the top of the stairs almost as soon as he began shooting. Dylan kept his on until he got to the library. Each costume change created another shooter. The school's location on a hill with nearby entrances on both floors allowed Eric and Dylan to be seen upstairs and downstairs almost simultaneously. The long-range weapons scattered gunfire over a shooting radius hundreds of yards wide. Distant witnesses had no idea where the shooters were. They only knew they were under attack. Some witnesses listened carefully and correctly located the source of the turbulence, but the bomb blasts often led them astray, particularly when bombs landed on the roof. Several kids were sure something was coming from up there. they spotted a frightened air conditioner repairman and instantly identified him as the rooftop gunman. Word whipped through the Columbine community. Kids called home on their cell phones the minute they got to safety, or someplace they hoped would remain safe. About 500 students were off campus, either for lunch or sick or cutting class. Their first sign of a problem came when they hit police barricades as they tried to return. Cops were everywhere, more cops than they had ever seen. Nate Dykeman was one of the kids heading back in. He was stunned by the stories he heard. Nate had gone home for lunch, same as he did every day. But on the way out, he had seen something peculiar. Eric walking into the building from the wrong parking lot at the wrong time. He should have been walking out. Eric and Dylan had both been missing that morning. They were up to something, obviously. Odd that they hadn't included him, or called, at least. Maybe not Eric. He wasn't the most thoughtful friend. But Dylan was. Dylan would have called. There had been some weird shit going on between those two lately. Pipe bombs and guns. When Nate heard about the shooting, he got nervous. When someone mentioned the trench coats, that sealed it. This isn't happening, Nate thought. This can't be happening. He ran into his girlfriend, who was stopped at an intersection. She was also a good friend of Eric's. She followed Nate home. Then Nate did the same thing nearly everyone was doing. He started dialing friends, checking in to make sure they were all safe. He wanted to call Dylan's house, but that was just way too scary. Soon, he would call soon. He checked on some other friends first. While Deputy Gardner was firing at Eric, he knew help was on the way. Female Down at a high school unleashed a frenzy of police radio traffic. Jeffco issued a metro-wide mutual aid request, prompting police officers, firefighters, and paramedics from around the city to begin racing toward the foothills. The police band got so congested so quickly that Gardner couldn't alert dispatch that he'd arrived. After engaging Eric, Gardner got back in his car and radioed for backup. This time, he got through. Gardner followed protocol and did not pursue Eric inside. Deputy Paul Smoker was a motorcycle cop, riding a speeding ticket on the edge of Clement Park when the first dispatch came in. He radioed that he was responding and gunned his motorcycle into the grass. He tore through soccer fields and baseball diamonds and arrived at the north side of the building just moments after Gardner's gunplay. He parked behind an equipment shed where a bleeding boy had taken shelter. Another patrol car pulled up right behind him, then another. They all wound around the corner from Gardner, just out of sight. The boy told them he had been shot by Ned Harris. Nobody had any paper, so a deputy wrote the name on the hood of his patrol car. They ran forward to help another bleeding student lying in the grass. As they approached, they passed into Deputy Gardner's sightline, around the corner. It had been 2 minutes since Gardner's gun battle with Eric, and he was out of his car with his pistol drawn. Smoker and Gardner spotted each other as Eric reappeared inside the west exit doorway. "There he is!" Gardner yelled. He opened fire again. Eric ducked back behind the doorframe. He poked his rifle through the shattered pane and returned fire. A couple of students were on the move again, and Eric tried to nail them too. Smoker could see where Gardner was firing, but the doorway was blocked from view. He maneuvered down to where he could see Eric and got off 3 shots. Eric retreated. Smoker heard gunfire inside. More students ran out of the building. He did not pursue. Deputies continued arriving. They attended to the scared and wounded and struggled to determine what they were up against. Witnesses came to them. Kids saw their police cars at the top of the hill and came running. Some were bleeding. All were desperate. They lined up behind the cars and crouched near the officers for protection. They provided lots of accurate information. Reports on the police radio conflicted wildly, but any one group in one location tended to offer remarkably consistent accounts. These kids described 2 gunmen in black trench coats shooting Uzis or shotguns and throwing hand grenades. At least one appeared to be high school age, and some victims knew them. Kids kept arriving. The cars were feeble protection, and the crowd was likely to draw attention. The deputies decided it was paramount to evacuate them. They directed some of the boys to tear their shirts into strips and treat one another's wounds while they devised an escape plan. They decided to line several patrol cars up as a defensive wall and shuttle the students to safer ground behind them. Every cop had been trained for events like this. Protocol called for containment. The deputies broke into watch teams. They could cover a handful of the 25 exits and protect those students who were already out. Setting up a perimeter, they called it. They would repeat the perimeter phrase endlessly that afternoon. Paramedics were establishing triage areas away from the school, and the deputies worked on getting the kids there. Cops would lay down suppressive fire to protect evacuations and scare off opportunistic attacks. They had no idea whether the gunmen were still present or interested. The officers did not observe or engage the gunmen for some time. Newly arriving officers covered additional exits. Gunfire was audible to the first officers and continued through the arrival of hundreds more. Deafening explosions kept erupting inside the school. The exterior walls along the cafeteria and the library rumbled from some of the blasts. Deputy Smoker could see the green windows buckling. Half a dozen students ran out the cafeteria doors after one shockwave. They made it to another deputy who was guarding the south exits. "Are we going to die?" one of the girls asked him. "No," she asked again. "No," she kept asking. The deputy thought the shooters might flee the building, cross the field, and hop a chain-link fence separating the school grounds from the first subdivision. We didn't know who the bad guy was, but we soon realized the sophistication of their weapons, Deputy Smoker said later. These were big bombs, big guns. We didn't have a clue who they were, but they were hurting kids. When the networks went live around noon, hundreds of uniformed responders were present. 35 law enforcement agencies were soon represented. They had gathered an assortment of vehicles, including a Loomis Fargo armored truck whose driver had been working in the area. One student counted 35 police cars speeding past him on his one-mile ride home from school. "Ambulances and police cars barging over medians and motorcycle cops weaving through opposite traffic, almost killing themselves," he said. Half a dozen cops arrived every minute. Nobody seemed to be in charge. Some cops wanted to assault the building, but that was not the plan. Whose plan was this? Where had it come from? They reinforced the perimeter. Eric had exchanged fire with two deputies at 11:24 and 11:26 a.m., 5 and 7 minutes into the attack. Law enforcement would not fire on the killers again or advance on the building until shortly after noon. 13. One bleeding to death. Ribbons of yellow police tape marked the perimeter. No one was getting out of there. The issue became getting in. Onlookers, journalists, and parents were appearing as fast as policemen. They presented little threat to the deputies, but significant danger to themselves. Misty Bernal was one of the early arrivals. She did not know that her daughter was in the library, or what that might portend. She only knew Cassie was missing, along with her freshman son, Chris. Misty's yard backed right up to the soccer field where Eric had fired on students, but she had arrived by a much more circuitous route. Misty was a working mom, so she was not present to hear Eric fire toward her house. But her husband, Brad, was. He had come home sick, heard a couple of pops, but thought nothing of them. Firecrackers, maybe some pranksters. He lived beside a high school. He was used to commotion. He didn't even put his shoes on to have a look. Half an hour later, Misty sat down to lunch with a coworker and got a disturbing call. It was probably nothing, but she called Brad to check. He put on his shoes. Brad went out back and peered over the fence. Bedlam. The schoolyard was swarming with cops. Misty Bernal was a tall, attractive woman in her mid-40s, with a loud voice and a commanding presence. She had full features and the same curly blonde hair as Cassie, worn in a similar style, though shorter, just past her shoulders. She could be mistaken for a much older sister. Brad was taller, with dark hair and handsome, a big guy with a soft voice and a humble demeanor. They shared an intense faith in the Lord, and they began begging him to save their kids. They could cover more ground apart. Misty headed for the high school. Brad hung by the phone. At the perimeter, officers struggled to hold back the parental onslaught. TV anchors broadcast their entreaties. As difficult as it may be, please stay away. But fresh waves of moms and dads kept swarming over the hill. Misty gave up. Two rendezvous points had been set up. Misty chose the public library on the other side of Clement Park. She found very few students. Where were they? When they poured out of the high school, students had seen two main options: a subdivision across Pierce Street or the wide-open fields of Clement Park. Hardly anyone chose the park. They crouched behind houses, worked themselves under shrubbery, rolled under cars, any semblance of protection. Some pounded frantically on front doors, but most of the houses were locked. Stay-at-home moms started waving strangers in off the street. Kids were piling into houses, one student said. There must have been 150 or 200 kids piled into this house. The second rendezvous point, Leawood Elementary, sat in the heart of that neighborhood, so most of the survivors gravitated there. Parents were sent to the auditorium, where kids were paraded across the stage. Moms shrieked, hugs abounded, unclaimed kids sobbed quietly backstage. Because the kids were hard to keep in one place, sign-in sheets were posted on the walls so parents could see evidence in their child's own hand. There was no parade of survivors at the public library. Misty was conflicted. Leaving for Leawood was risky. The roads had been closed, so everything was by foot now. She could easily miss her kids in transit. A local minister got up on a chair and shouted, "Please, stay here!" The facts would arrive any minute, he assured them. They would be much better off waiting. The fax was a copy of the sign-in sheets from Leawood. Misty waited impatiently for its arrival. The mood stayed tense, but restrained. Commotion erupted in little bursts. "Paul's okay!" A woman screamed. She held up her cell phone. "He's at Leawood!" Her husband rushed over. They hugged. They wept. Tears were rare. It was too scary to cry in fear. Only reunion allowed release. A clump of students would appear now and then over the hill. If they weren't claimed immediately, a pack of moms would descend to interrogate them. Always the same question. "How did you get out?" They needed reassurance there was a way out. "I didn't know what to do," a young girl said. "We heard guns and I was standing there and the teacher was crying and pointing to the auditorium and everybody was running and screaming and we heard an explosion. I guess that was a bomb or something. I didn't see this, but we were trying to find out and I guess they shot again and everyone started running and I was like, 'What is going on?' They started shooting again and there was complete panic. People were shoving, they were going into the elevators and people would like push people off and we were all just running." Most of the stories sputtered out like that, disjointed flurries of recreated mayhem. The words ran together until the witness ran out of breath. A winsome freshman was different. She was still in her Columbine gym uniform and recounted her escape dispassionately. She had faced the gunman in the hall. She was pretty sure one had run right past her, shooting. But there was so much smoke and confusion, she wasn't sure what was happening, or where, or anything. Bullets ricocheted down the corridor, glass shattered, metal clattered, chunks of plaster crashed down on the floor. Moms gasped. Someone asked if she'd feared for her life. "Not really," she said, "because the principal was with us." She said it matter-of-factly, with earnest conviction. It was just the tone a younger girl might have used to explain that she felt safe with her daddy. The stories were harrowing, but they reassured the moms. Every escape was different, but they ended the same. The kids escaped. The accumulation was soothing. Misty questioned every kid. "Cassie!" she shouted. "Chris!" She worked her way across the crowd and back again. Nothing. Command had fallen to the newly elected Jeffco sheriff, John Stone. He had not yet faced a murder case in office. The Metro cops were horrified to discover that the county was in charge. Many were open with their disgust. City and even suburban officers thought of sheriff's deputies as security guards. These were the guys who shuttled defendants to court from the jail. They stood guard while the real cops testified about the crimes they had responded to and investigated. The grousing increased when they learned who was heading the command. John Stone looked the part of an Old West sheriff, a big, burly guy with a large pot belly and a thick gray mustache, weathered skin, and craggy eyes. He wore the uniform, the badge, and the pistol, but he was a politician. He had been a county supervisor for 12 years. He'd run for sheriff last November and had taken the oath in January. He appointed John Dunaway as his undersheriff, another bureaucrat. The sheriff and his team defended the perimeter. Gun blasts came and went. The SWAT teams seethed. When was somebody going to allow them to advance? Dunaway named Lieutenant David Walcher incident commander. Operations would now be directed by a man who did police work for a living, with oversight from Dunaway and Sheriff Stone. The three set up a command post in a trailer stationed in Clement Park, half a mile north of the school. Just after noon, a SWAT team made its first approach on the school. The officers commandeered a fire truck for cover. One man drove the truck slowly toward the building, while a dozen more moved alongside. Near the entrance, they split in half, six and six. Lieutenant Terry Manwaring's team held back to lay down suppressive fire and later work its way to another entrance. At approximately 12:06, the other six charged inside. Additional SWAT team members arrived moments later and followed them. The team thought they were in striking distance of the cafeteria. They were on the opposite end of the building. Lieutenant Manwaring had been inside Columbine many times, but he was unaware it had been remodeled and the cafeteria moved. He was perplexed.